Past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, featuring unique shopping and the historic Jack's Cafe, featuring an eclectic menu, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, modernized for a new age. Visit jackandrea.com for more information. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program for Black History Month, we'll look back more than a century to the life of a talented black man who was this country's most celebrated jockey. In part two of today's program, we'll preview what promises to be an extraordinary night of music with the Lake County Symphony Orchestra. Here's part one. I'm really excited to be able to share with you for the next few minutes the inspiring story of a very talented black athlete. Someone, unfortunately, who is largely forgotten by the general public, his name, Jimmy Wingfield. He was a jockey. In fact, the last of the great black jockeys. And his story is told in a new book called Black Maestro, The Epic Life of an American Legend. The author is Joe Drape, a reporter for the New York Times, and also the author of The Race for the Triple Crown. He has really done a great job here of telling us an important story and also laying it carefully within the context of the historic precedent for the great black jockeys who left such a mark on their sport, and also the heartbreaking story of how that began to turn and how these opportunities began to be taken away from these gifted young writers. The book, again, is published by William Morrow, a division of HarperCollins, the book, again, called Black Maestro, and Joe Drape, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, thanks for having me.
This story is so odd when we compare it, for instance, to the story of someone like Jackie Robinson or Althea Gibson. I mean, we are so often talking about the first black to break into the ranks of a given sport. This is exactly the opposite. When we talk about Jimmy Wingfield, we are talking about the last black. It's such an odd thing. Just help us understand that for a moment about how the story of an inspiring black athlete can be such a sort of a story in reverse from those which we're normally concerned with.
Well, what happened is, you know, people don't realize that 15 of the first 28 Kentucky Derbies were won by black riders. And it makes a lot of sense, which I found in my research, is, you know, slaves took care of the horses in central Kentucky and in Virginia. They were the trainers, the grooms, the riders. Horses were treasures. There was a whole handed-down legacy of slaves, of black men, teaching the younger generation how you handle a horse. So, you know, Civil War comes. They're emancipated. Yes, they go right into the Derby. They are the most famous athletes in America at the time, next to boxers. But there's a backlash to Reconstruction, and Jim Crow laws start coming down. You can't ride on the same bus, the same train, separate water fountains. And going hand-in-hand with that, there's an influx in New York of Irish immigrants coming into the States. And there's an organized crime element of Irish gangsters up here. And they figure out, hey, these little street urchins, we can teach to box, cycle, and ride horses. We can buy them from their parents for $25 a year, and we can send them out to all these tracks and take a cut of their earnings. And that's exactly what happened. So, you know, you had Jim Crow from the macro, and then inside the track, you had these white boys, and they were tough guys, and they were just trying to survive too. But they're riding side by side with these African-American jockeys and punching them, running them into the rails. I mean, Jimmy almost died in Chicago in 1902. Because a guy ran him into the rail because they wanted the black jockeys off the circuit. So, you know, I came across this story. I covered horse racing for the Times. I see two paragraphs on Jimmy Wingfield. He's the last black jockey to win the Derby. 1901 and 1902, one of four ever to do it back-to-back. But, you know, what really caught my eye, Greg, is not only what kicked him out of America, but then this remarkable life he embarks on there. I mean, you know, some people call him a real-life Forrest Gump. He lived through two world wars and was like a principal participant in the Bolshevik Revolution. He has this extraordinary trail drive that makes Lonesome Dove look like a walk in the park, of saving 262 of the finest horses in America, or in all the world, in Europe, driving them from Odessa, 1,100 miles over 3 months, to Warsaw, getting shot at by the Bolsheviks, starving along the way. You know, again, Hitler, World War II, and he ends up back here in Depression-era America. So, you know, in total, it's very sad what happened to him. It would be like LeBron James right now being told, hey, you can't play in the NBA anymore. You got to go make a living somewhere else. But that's exactly what happened to Jimmy.
And it's, well, and of course, it didn't just happen to him, but it happened to all of his compatriots, his colleagues, his fellow black jockeys. It's interesting, too, as you help us understand the historic context and that period when there were many great black jockeys, it's interesting what they were able to enjoy. You said the racetrack offered dignity to a black man who had a touch with horses, but it was a dignity that could be challenged at any time and taken away in an instant. I mean, at a glance, it might appear that black jockeys were being treated equally. In fact, that was never quite the case, but at least it was a place where they really had some opportunities that would have been more elusive in other arenas.
Yeah, and there's an old slave saying that was passed down by these jockeys, is the only two places men are equal are on the turf and below it. Basically saying at the track there is this uneasy respect, and then when you were dead. And, you know, Jimmy grew up at a time where 300 people, many of them his neighbors, were getting hung all around him. If you'd looked at a white guy cross or said something that offended his family, that you could be beaten or worse, hung, shot. And, you know, I outline a couple of those things. So,
and you also, if I may jump in, there's that quote that just kind of makes us ill. You quote some kind of publication from down south saying, well, the favorite Christmas tree decoration this year seems to be black men hanging from nooses.
Right.
I mean, it's a chilling, chilling thought.
You know, and it was a chilling time, and I will give Jimmy, I think that whole period braced him and prepped him for what was to come. I mean, I think the things that he learned there was, A, he had an incredible gift with horses, and he worked hard on it. In those days, you didn't just show up and get on a horse. 7 years old, he was taken in, given the oral tradition by older grooms and trainers. He didn't really get on his first horse till he was 14. He didn't ride his first race until he was 18. It was old school. You worked your way up from top to bottom. So, you know, he knew he had a gift. He knew he had to work to keep with that gift. And he also knew that he was in a precarious place in society, that at any moment, as you mentioned, it could be taken away from you.
I'm reminded of one of these earlier figures who you tell us about, someone named Isaac Murphy. And you say he was among jockeys, he was the biggest black star of them all, and in fact, the biggest star in all of American sports at his peak, which is really something. You go on to say a little later, after kind of outlining his career, he was a star, even if he was one that shone in a segregated and subservient constellation.
Yeah, Isaac Murphy was, you know, horse racing was our national sport at that time in the 1870s and 1880s. And, you know, it makes sense. Baseball was just in its infancy. Boxers were pretty big, but Isaac Murphy had it all. He was a well-spoken African-American. He even had a white valet, something Jimmy emulated when he got to Russia. He was making more money than any other athlete in there. But sure enough, you know, and it goes back to this taking away. He wins all these derbies, all these American futurities, the Belmont. He's still one of the most decorated riders ever. But near the end of his career, and he was a young man at the end of his career, he was accused of being a drunk, being a drug user, and basically it was racially tinged insults that happened. And, you know, you'd read the language in the newspapers of the day, and, you know, they all but are out using words that we wouldn't even say in public.
Hmm. One of the things that is kind of touching as we follow Jimmy's development as a jockey is that we realize that this is the kind of trade which one did not learn by going to school someplace. You really learned it by hanging around the track, by talking to other jockeys, by, in a sense, really needing the generosity and interest of people who are already in the business. And apparently, Jimmy had a real gift for getting people to open up to him and to share this life with him. And, of course, the other thing is he was observing the every move of the great jockeys on how they did what they did and why.
And, Greg, that's really a great point to pick up. This was a guy who found the right benefactors from age 7 on. He'd sit on that fence, those limestone fences, and watch those boys ride the horses around. And then he finally bugged them enough, and they'd bring them into the barn. They'd teach them how to rub the horse. They'd start telling them what means what, you know, what touch means what. He hooks up with a couple old white trainers, you know, small-time guys. One's daddy was the mayor of Lexington, dedicated horseman. They start putting him through the paces where he can only walk a horse for a while. Then they give him a stopwatch and say, okay, click off a quarter of a mile. They make him walk every inch of the track every day because it's in his job to know where every rock, pebble, hole is. He then goes and hooks up in Chicago with Big Ed Corrigan, who's one of my favorite figures out of this whole thing, who was the owner and builder of Hawthorne Racetrack, who was a gangster and a gambler. And basically, he had hired Isaac Murphy. He and Isaac Murphy had won a bunch of races together, so he had an affinity for African Americans. And, you know, this guy gets in incredible brawls, but at the same time, has a soft spot for Jimmy, and he gives him a start. When he gets to Russian, and, you know, you've just pointed out the educational arc. There's no school books involved in this. Jimmy had a seventh-grade education. He was 5 feet, 100 pounds. When he finally gets run out of America, after this remarkable run at the Derbies, he goes over to Russia by himself with a Polish-to-English dictionary because he's going to Warsaw, and he meets this man, Michael Lazarev, and Jack Keane, who was an old horseman from Kentucky, and Keeneland Racetracks named after him, had been over there, and he'd gotten run out of Russia, allegedly for cheating. So he hooks those two guys up. And Michael Lazarev is not only a dedicated horseman, he's as rich as the Vanderbilts and the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds at the time. He's an Armenian who controls the Baku oil fields. He has a sterling operation, and who really wanted to breed racehorses that could run in England and France and, you know, take his place among the kings and captains of industry. And, you know, this guy imparts all his knowledge to Jimmy. I mean, that really, you know, his gift and this knack for, I guess, just soaking up all the knowledge out of people who were smarter than him.
Hmm. Of course, things change so dramatically for him, and one of the things that changes the prospects for black riders is the creation of something called the Anti-Colored Union, and the way in which the Jockey Club of New York City began organizing itself more like a private club with all kinds of regulations, which, among other things, seemed to begin running blacks out of the business. You say that some of those efforts were to try to bring the chaos of horse racing under some control, but how tragic that towards that end it would be carried out in the way that it was, and that measure of control would be extended to exclude these gifted black jockeys.
You know, they had high-minded goals, but unfortunately, they were low-minded folks. And these were some of the richest industrialists in the world at the point. The Jockey Club, yes, they wanted to say, okay, let's everybody get under one group, have one set of rules, one set of infractions, one set of punishments, because there were tracks all over everywhere. There were more than 300 at the time. But the Jockey Club also was formed to keep Jews and Italians out of the ownership ranks, and eventually to keep blacks off the racetrack. And the anti-colored union was fronted by the white jockeys who were up here in New York, but it was really these guys involved in it because New York didn't like the African-American influence. They weren't used to it like they were down south in Kentucky. And the African-Americans were the best riders, and they'd have to come up here and win all their races. And this irked the power structure here. And down south, they wanted to keep riding black riders, and it was just a matter of economics. These fights and skirmishes that would break out in the racetracks was hurting their horses, and they couldn't risk their horse to ride a guy like Jimmy anymore.
Hmm. And, of course, that's one of the most heartbreaking things, too, is that, you know, you have these jockeys who are looking for mounts, looking for trainers who will let them, the jockeys, ride a given horse. And you talk about how, for Jimmy, one of the most heartbreaking things was not only his own difficulty in getting mounts, but he would see some of the greatest black jockeys who had ever been now forced into this situation of indignity, of having to sort of go almost like beggars from trainer to trainer, desperate for one to be willing to take the risk to allow a black jockey to ride their horse. I mean, these black jockeys who had tasted such great success and triumph just years before.
It was devastating for him up here in New York to see Willie Sims, who not only had won all these Belmonts, won Derbies, he's in the Hall of Fame now, but he was the first American rider to go to England and rode for the Queen over there and killed him over there. They hated him over there because he won everything. And, you know, 2 years after that, after being at the top of the world, he's out here in Belmont Park doing the same thing Jimmy is. You know, please let me ride. I'll ride a couple of your nags this morning if you give me a mount in the afternoon. And this was a guy Jimmy got to learn from because they were at Latonia Park together. Jimmy was just an apprentice trainer groom at that point. Sims was the biggest jockey. And he'd follow Sims around, and he'd watch him when he was working out horses. And, you know, he knew that Jimmy had foresight, too, because before he left, he knew he had to leave the country 5 years before he left because he saw what was going on with Sims. And he thought, you know, if the greatest rider in the world can't get a ride, what am I going to do?
Hmm. Well, of course, he returns to Kentucky where black jockeys still enjoyed fair access to the race. And there, to the racing world, and there he manages to win the Kentucky Derby twice in a row, and the first time riding a horse called His Eminence, and achieving this great success. At one point in the book, you talk about how this figure of Jimmy Wingfield had going for him an interesting combination of dignity and street smarts.
Yeah, I mean, Jimmy was no saint. He knew enough. He could mix. He's one of those people who can mix with the czars and the princes, which he did frequently, and who could play a good dice game in the back room of a black boarding house. And he did know where his place was in any given room. In fact, I got cross-eyed from a night in Chicago, rolling dice, drinking moonshine. In Chicago, where he was probably most comfortable, he hung down on the south side in the gambling halls and brothels of the Tenderloin District, and he knew the score. He knew who he could trust and who he couldn't trust. And he also had this great personal elan and style, these nice double-breasted suits, these sweater vests were his trademark. And he could waltz into a room full of rich aristocracy, white folks, and not look out of place, too.
And that, of course, served him well in this business as well. He realizes, of course, that America is an increasingly dangerous place and really an increasingly impossible place for him to pursue this work. So he heads abroad, and of course, that's where some of the most extraordinary adventures happen for Wingfield. Tell our listeners really quickly the story of the saving of the horses. I mean, this is something straight out of a movie script.
He's up in Odessa, which is the Saratoga of the Empire at this point. The revolution's in full bore. He considers himself a white Russian, meaning aristocracy. He's up there with some rich guys. They, like everybody, think, okay, we're waited out here. We're beat back the Bolsheviks, and then we'll go back and return to our high life. April 4th, 1919 comes along. Cannons boom. The French abandon. All of a sudden, Odessa's under siege. There's an old Polish officer named Jurchevich who had a plan, who saw this coming. Just like that, two dozen men round up 262 horses and the women and children and start to drive towards Warsaw. They got to go a long way away, Bucharest, to drop the kids and children and women off. The whole time, they're getting shot at. You know, thoroughbreds are not meant to be ridden 1,100 miles over 3 months. They're meant to run fast 2 minutes every 2 weeks. So they're starving. There's no food to be had. When they go into villages, they're beset upon by people who think they're gypsies. So, you know, this was one of the most remarkable, remarkable things. And, you know, to this day, Greg, that is like one of the greatest moments in Polish history, because when they get to Warsaw, it's now independent Poland. They've been liberated from the Russian Empire. And if you're good with a horse in that part of the world, you're known to have a touch of Wingfield.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it was the most fun of the research, was trying to piece together this just harrowing journey.
Well, and of course, his life is fascinating even from there, and the success he's able to enjoy in Europe as a jockey, and then how it kind of all comes crashing down, and the tragedy of losing his son, and then rebuilding his life and eventually returning to America, raising horses and establishing success for himself in another way. Tell our listeners the intriguing way in which you open this book. I think you are making such an interesting point here as you tell the story, which you do in the book's introduction, from the 3rd of May, 1961.
And he was invited back to the 61 Derby. The week before, Sports Illustrated does a nice long piece set in France where he's living about this guy, this last black rider, this two-time winner.
And it had been 60 years before that he
right,
would have won the Derby.
60 years. He's had this interesting life of trail drives, wars, Bolsheviks. So they invite him to a dinner at the Brown Hotel, which is the luxury hotel still there in Louisville, Kentucky. He goes with his 37-year-old daughter, Lillian, who at the time is married to a white surgeon who's a graduate of Fisk University, who is a liberated liberal woman. They go up to the front door. Another black man, the porter, doorman there, says, "We don't let you people come in." They kind of look at each other. Says, "You know, we're invited guests." "No, no blacks are allowed here. You can't come in the front door." And to me, that moment said everything. It said, here's a guy who's accomplished everything, still not being recognized. But it also said what Jimmy was. Jimmy didn't yell. Jimmy didn't go to the back door. Jimmy stood there and kept sending the guy back in. "Go find the guy from Sports Illustrated. Go find the guy from Sports Illustrated." He basically wore him down and walked in that front door 20 minutes late, but he did it with great style and dignity. Again, the word dignity, I keep coming back with him. And, you know, he faced this room full of white people. Nobody talked to him. He kept a big smile on his face, and he left through the front door. And to me, that kind of, I chose to open it that way because that encapsulated who he was and what he had dealt with.
It's an amazing story, and I suppose it must be especially thrilling for you to tell a story that up until now has been so obscure. I mean, you are really righting a wrong here, in a sense, by helping the American public understand and appreciate this important figure from our sports history.
You know, you hope to shed a little light on it. You know, books are labors of love. Somebody told me they're literate people's lottery. None of us get rich on this. I cover horses, among other things, for the Times. I've been just entranced with the whole sport and the characters involved in it. And you better want to love in your subject, because otherwise it is just work. And when I came across him, you know, it offered an opportunity to just try to learn this tapestry of history, of, you know, European and global history. Try to get the American scene, when it was probably its most racist, to lay it over this beautiful sport. And, you know, I don't mean being to be flip when I say this, but, you know, for 4.5 years in my reporting and in my writing, I got to be a 5-foot black man at the turn of the century, going through this world wide-eyed. And you try to put yourself in, you know, 10 times a day, I said, what could he have possibly thought when he saw this? And it was fun. And if people can take this story, and it really transcends sports and it transcends horses. It's a story about a guy who never quit. It's that simple. And got to see a wonderful world. And, you know, he made some mistakes. We all do. He's like many celebrities and athletes. He was very flawed. One very good husband, was a better father late in life. But, you know, he had a remarkable life, and people should know about it.
And thankfully now they can, through your wonderful book called Black Maestro, The Epic Life of an American Legend, published by William Morrow, the author Joe Drape. Joe Drape, this is really an exceptionally interesting book, and I'm really glad we could talk about it today on The Morning Show. I'm glad you wrote the book, and thank you for joining me on The Morning Show.
It was my pleasure. It was a tremendous conversation. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. And for this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, I'm really happy to be reconnecting with one of the most capable musicians I know, Ron Arden, with whom I've had the pleasure of collaborating on several different occasions. Ron Arden, among other things, is the conductor of the Lake County Symphony Orchestra. And with them, he has certainly put together some intriguing programs over the years. And there is yet another one coming up tomorrow night that we want to talk about today on The Morning Show. It is a concert titled Timeless Classics. It will feature great music by both Beethoven and Ray Vaughan Williams, and a brand new work by a local composer named Charles Brown called Poem for American Acrimony. And I'm really pleased that I can speak with Ron Arden for the next few minutes about this program and about all three works, but especially this brand new works that has been crafted, especially for the Lake County Symphony Orchestra, or at least I believe that to be the case. Ron Arden, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Thanks, Greg. It's good to be with you.
So was I correct in assuming that this piece by Charles Brown is receiving its world premiere, or is it just a very new work that you guys are playing for the first time?
No, Charles is our composer in residence. This is his second full season, and this is a world premiere.
We should say that our WGTD listeners might remember a past conversation we had with him about a concerto he wrote for your orchestra involving the hammered dulcimer. And that's, you don't come across those kind of works every day. This particular piece has a very intriguing backstory in terms of kind of the national situation that prompted its creation. Tell us more about that.
Well, it does. Charles feels deeply. He's an extremely intelligent and spiritual person, and feels deeply that Americans have for some years now and intensely right now lost the ability to treat each other socially and politically with respect, and to listen carefully to each other, and to be able to disagree without slamming each other in words and deeds. And so the piece is a reflection musically. It's very programmatic of how Charles feels about those things. It includes a mezzo-soprano, Melanie Carter from Gurnee, is singing that part, and a narrator, Pastor Larry McCarthy from Moody Church, is the narrator. And I have to tell you, Greg, it's a not-to-be-missed moment. Charles opens with Melanie singing a beautiful rendition of the first verse of America the Beautiful. And then Charles' brother, Don Brown, has written a very, shall we say, critical verse. And the tune goes into a minor key, and Melanie sings that. Then there are a couple of movements that that literally sound like the orchestra is fighting with itself. There's no other better way to describe it. And then there are quotes from various presidents on the order of Aaron Copland's Lincoln portrait, but not as much narration. There are some intriguing quotes from presidents who are good friends on either side of the fence will be alarmed to hear come from their party. And the quote, I'm not going to give away the thunder, but one of them in particular will be very intriguing for folks to hear, that years ago, presidents stood in, and I'm talking 50 or 60 years ago, presidents stood and gave speeches that included reprimands to the American people that they needed to get their social act together and treat each other with respect and honor. And so then Charles at the end obviously doesn't leave us hanging. He's a spiritual man. He offers an alternative behavior, and it's very hopeful. So
wow.
I am just flummoxed by this piece. And Charles is a new composer to the scene, but he's extremely formidable. And his orchestrations are difficult and challenging and colorful and exciting. It's just really going to be fantastic.
Can you just say a word about what the collaborative process has been like? I mean, in some cases, a composer just plunks something in your lap and says, here it is, play it. And in other cases, there is a bit more in terms of deliberate collaboration and partnership in the creative process. Which would be a better description of how this work has taken shape?
Well, the idea, he and I have been talking about this for a couple of years now, but the idea, of course, is Charles' passion, and I happen to share his passion about America's social structure presently, politically and spiritually. But we have what would be called more of a collaborative effort. I'm obviously not writing the music, and I'm not telling him how to write it, but Charles really likes to send me first drafts and get my opinions about things. He wants to talk about orchestration. He wants to talk about, do you think this works? Do you think this is too hard? Do you think this is too easy? And I, you know, I've really, I've been in the wonderful position of being able to say, Charles, follow your heart. You know, write what's in there, and I'm sure that it will have, you know, a tremendous outcome. And you're right, sometimes composers get commissioned to, say, write a violin concerto or a symphony, and they just dump it in the lap of the orchestra. That's not how we've worked. In fact, the next work for next season will be a requiem, and Charles and I have already talked about how that will be fashioned and shaped. And I enjoy that dialogue. It's probably a little bit more complicated than lots of conductors and composers want, but it is really exciting. And he really likes to have the musicians' feedback. It's nice to have him close by. You know, he'll be at all the rehearsals. He'll be at the concert. In fact, he and his brother and I will be doing what I call an informance before we play the work. The audience doesn't know that yet. Well, now they do. but that will be an opportunity for them to hear firsthand what it's like to work together on a piece like this. So, and plus, as you can imagine, Greg, because you're a professional musician, it's the first time it's been printed. So there are various mistakes and adjustments and things that need to be taken care of so that the musicians can read the music clearly. And Charles uses an engraver actually from Australia. Or New Zealand, I forget which, for that process. And so we dialogue with him as well about what's the best way to format the music, what's the cleanest, what's the clearest. And I would say this engraver is top drawer. I play in the Wisconsin Phil and the Kenosha Symphony and some other orchestras, and I play new music, and I got to tell you, some of it's tremendously difficult to read, which makes the playing not the best it could be.
Right. I should think that makes the experience seem much more labored
yeah.
for really entirely unnecessary reasons. I mean, it's probably
Absolutely.
Already challenging enough just from a musical point of view, but then if you are getting a headache just from trying to read the notes themselves, that's no
right.
fun for anybody.
Right. Well, these parts are pristine, clear, and easy to read. It's really, really good stuff.
Very good. And as you've already said, but it probably bears repeating, it sounds like Charles Brown has taken care to be even-handed as he approaches this topic and this concern. I mean, this is not a bunch of quotes from Democrats saying how dumb the Republicans are, or quotes from Republicans saying how dumb the Democrats are. This is something that is to speak to all Americans of all political stripes. Very good.
Yes.
Again, it's titled Poem for American Acrimony. What an intriguing title, and that sounds like that really embraces the heart of the matter. Let's talk about
the
other...
It could be more timely. I mean, how could it be more timely than right now? It's just amazing. Yeah.
I agree. Let's talk about the other two works on the program as well. One of them is a rarity, although I remember a few years back when the Kenosha Symphony actually played the Ray Vaughan Williams Tuba Concerto. But it is exceedingly uncommon, and so what a rare treat for Lake County Symphony Orchestra goers to hear this work in its entirety. What prompted you to program it?
Well, that's a good story. About 2 years ago, a little under 2 years ago, we were auditioning for Principal Tuba, and a gentleman named Josh Savigny from Milwaukee was one of our auditionees, and we have a policy with the orchestra that we invite people to audition ahead of a concert series, and then we have them play the concert series so that we can not only see how they handle the excerpts for the audition and interview them for membership, and then we see how they operate in the section. And so after Josh played with us a couple of times, he came to me after he won the chair. He played brilliantly, by the way, in the audition, and is a really wonderful person. He said, "Is there any chance that I could play the Vaughan Williams?" Well, lo and behold, it is a piece that I have loved for a long time and would really love to conduct it. So I said, I have a caveat. A lot of wind and brass players play with orchestras and they use music. And I said, I need it to be memorized. And he said, it's already memorized. I said, you've got it. So last spring, we programmed it on the concert for tomorrow night. And he tells me that he plays it 3 or 4 times a day. It's only about 13 minutes, but it is a glorious, wonderful piece, unlike a lot of other Vaughan Williams. It's a great piece.
And I find in particular how striking the instrumentation is. And and in some ways, I mean, the tuba is a big instrument, I mean, physically, but it is not a work that is not an instrument that sort of shines brilliantly like a trumpet. And if you're not careful, a tuba can kind of get subsumed in the texture. And it seems to me, anyway, that just never happens, that Vaughan Williams really has crafted a showpiece in which the tuba is shown off beautifully.
Right. That's a really good summation of the work. I've been studying it. I rarely listen to music I'm conducting because I really want to study from the score and know it from what's on the page. But I listened to a couple performances and have been wowed, as you said, by Vaughan Williams' ability to make sure that the tuba is never buried, because it does have a timbre that is a solo instrument. If you were not careful, you would lose the articulation and the flavor of the instrument in front of the orchestra. So it's really well orchestrated.
And we want to mention the Beethoven Leonora Overture No. 3 that is also on the program. Maybe you want to give at least the brief version of why there's more than one Leonora Overture by Beethoven, and, of course, a little bit about what makes this particular overture extra special.
Well, that's kind of a wild story, but I'll do it briefly. This is our, you know, beginning of our particular celebration of Beethoven's 250th birthday that's being celebrated all around the world. So we're doing an overture on this program. The next concert in April, we'll be doing Beethoven's 3rd. At any rate, I love the Leonora Overture. It is, a little story, the very first piece of not watered-down classical music that I ever played in all-state orchestra in Indiana. And I had never seen so many fast notes in my whole life. But the history of the piece is Beethoven actually wrote 3 overtures. He was sort of unsatisfied with them. They're from his only opera, Fidelio. And what ended up happening was the 3rd, which we're doing, it's the longest of the 3, became affectionately more well-known, to the point that when people have performed the opera, they literally insert the overture at the end of the opera before the curtain goes down, which Beethoven would have absolutely abhorred. So it's, in my personal opinion, this particular overture is quintessential Beethoven. It's subtle, it's bombastic, it's introspective. There are great solo moments. It's explosive and very well crafted. It's 14 minutes of, if you wanted to introduce Beethoven to somebody, this would be a really great way to do it.
I agree. One of the negative things I sometimes say about Beethoven, and that feels really audacious, but I think sometimes Beethoven does not know how to finish things. I mean, and I don't mean in every piece, but I can think of a short list of pieces where I feel like I really like it, except the ending just kind of goes on and on and on and on. This is not right. One of those pieces. I feel like it's brilliant start to finish, and in particular, its final climax is just one of the most thrilling passages in all of music.
I would agree with you. Yeah, totally. And it has these amazing solos for pairs of flutes and bassoons that I think up until that time were not really heard like that. And he doesn't use the oboes and the clarinets as much, and the bassoons have these wonderful duets to play that are reflective of what the flute does. So it's just really, and then I don't know if audiences would be interested in this, but they can hear it tomorrow night. It's got this interesting, very weird passage where everything comes to a standstill and the violins play a motive that eventually tumbles forward, and the musical idea is off the beat. It's almost like a hemiola, and I remember playing it, and I'm looking at it in the score thinking, this throws musicians because they're not ready for a scale to begin on the offbeat in the middle of a measure. And then eventually, as the whole string section comes in, it lands on the beat, but it's a very odd moment in Beethoven's writing, and I think in classical music. You probably know the spot.
he thought outside the box great courage and ingenuity, and it's a great piece. So, and what a great concert then, Beethoven, Vaughan Williams, and this brand new work by your composer in residence, Charles Brown, Poem for American Acrimony. The concert tomorrow night, 7:30 in the Village Church of Gurnee. And for more information, you can go to the website of the Lake County Symphony Orchestra, which is lakecountysymphonyorchestra.com. And their fearless leader, Ron Arden. Ron Arden, great to talk with you, and best wishes to you and all of your musicians with tomorrow night's concert.
Thanks, I really appreciate it.
And now I have a few minutes with the composer in residence, Charles Brown, talking about this latest work he has crafted for the Lake County Symphony Orchestra, again titled Poem for American Acrimony. And certainly that title speaks vividly to the times in which we find ourselves. Charles Brown, I'm really glad we can talk about what you thought about as you shaped this work. What kinds of things did you consider? What kinds of choices confronted you in how this work should be put together and what it should say?
Thanks for asking, Greg, and it's a pleasure to be here. So my brother Don and I composed this over about a five-month period as we observed the political landscape in this country, and that it is our belief that we have never been, at least since the Civil War, in such an acrimonious environment where the left and the right political persuasion of American citizens has become so distasteful and disdainful. And so we pulled from speeches from past presidents, from Jefferson, from Lincoln, from Harry Truman, from John Kennedy. And Don wrote some original lyrics, and I structured this piece in six movements. So we introduce in movement one, America the Beautiful, very traditional, and then it quickly goes south in the second verse. The second movement structure is, I guess, the beginning of the acrimony. So the listener will probably be a little fidgety during this because there's a lot of atonalness in the music representing the political bickering. The third movement is sort of sad, actually, and I think it's the a sole female singer with the orchestra recognizing that she's just sad that the country has come to this, and her final words are, "Weep not, America, it's not going to end this way." The fourth movement is when we brought in the words from Harry Truman, where he's reminding us that, look, we're all one people. In the very beginning, our founding fathers, Greg, didn't agree on everything, but they didn't, try to set out and destroy each other. The fifth movement is sort of a tribute to the media, which, candidly, I said to Don, you can imagine sitting in a chair, Greg, and hearing Rush Limbaugh in front of you, Fox News behind you, Sean Hannity on your side, and Wolf Blitzer on another side, and they're all talking at the same time, 24 hours a day, and so the listener at that point is going to feel pretty despondent at the end of that movement. But it's necessary to set up the final movement, which is America, a miracle, and that really is the theme. Those three words are the theme of the whole piece, Greg. America, a miracle. And we hope people will leave after listening for 35 minutes and feel like, wow, we've got a shot here. And each listener can make their own decision to not contribute to the acrimony.
Are you at all nervous about how this might be received by certain people? And how much did you think about that as you crafted this? I mean, given the fact that we live in such divisive times, and while I certainly hope that there are plenty of people who are open to the message of this piece, there are probably others who probably are not. Have you thought very much about that?
We absolutely thought about it, and it would do no good if we literally contributed to the acrimony rather than set out to ease the acrimony. I am a more conservative individual. My brother is as well, but we recognize that a good portion of an audience at this kind of concert may not be. So we were careful to choose quotes. Believe it or not, probably about 80% of the quotes are from Democrat presidents and their wordage and from speeches. So we think it's fairly balanced. We certainly aren't saying this is how you should believe. What we are saying is that America, which survived the British literally trying to tear us from our liberty 250 years ago, it's a miracle that it survived that, and it's a miracle that it survived the Civil War, Greg, and that we need to focus on the good rather than the bad. We're always going to have differences, but civility is something that we simply can't discard. And there are problems with this on the left and the right. We're recording this interview on a Friday, and just 10 days ago, the Speaker of the House ripped up a speech from the president. That shouldn't have happened. But there are also people on the right that are very hard-nosed and condescending to those on the left. And neither of those is conducive to having harmonious existence here in America. And that's why we wrote the piece, and we were willing, Greg, to take some heat. There may be some after the concert. I hope not, but there may be.
Hmm. Poem for American Acrimony. It will receive its world premiere at the concert Saturday night, February 22nd, by the Lake County Symphony Orchestra. Charles Brown, I thank you so much for your thoughtful words and for bringing this important work to the world. Thank you so much.
Greg, thank you for this opportunity. Take care.
For information on the concert Saturday evening, February 22nd, you can go to lakecountysymphonyorchestra.com. I'm Gregory Bird. Monday on the morning show for Black History Month, Elliot Jaspin and his fascinating yet troubling book called Buried in the Bitter Waters, The Hidden History of Racial Cleansing in America. It tells the almost inconceivable story of how our own history is dotted with incidents in which entire communities, sometimes entire counties, were rid of their black residents one way or another. An important story by a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. That's on Monday's morning show. We remind you that the morning show is available as a podcast. Look for the title, The Morning Show with Greg Berg. A couple of very special things are planned for the podcast this weekend. Tomorrow, the 22nd of February, you'll hear my interview with the great Marnie Nixon. She supplied the singing voice for the lead roles in the films of The King and I, West Side Story, and My Fair Lady. And we talk about her memoir called I Could Have Sung All Night. And on the 23rd, Sunday,